Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to On the Couch with Dr. Michelle, right here on LA Talk Radio.
This is Dr. Michelle Cohen, and you are officially on the couch, as you always are here, Fridays, 11 in the morning Pacific Standard Time, in our beautiful Los Angeles studios. LA Talk Radio, the most irreverent, entertaining, and cool talk radio station. Welcome, everyone. And my friends, today we have absolutely one of my favorite guests, and I know yours too because of the feedback I receive whenever he's on the show. So we're going to be talking about some fascinating subjects. And if you're a regular listener, you probably recall that I've had Dr. Mark Rubenstein on the show before, many times, throughout the past two and some years, to talk about his books and pick his brain about his vast knowledge of psychiatry and basically learn about why people do the things they do. Yeah. Now, if you want to go into the archives, or if you're a regular listener, last December I spoke to Dr. Rubenstein about his fascinating nonfiction book, Bedlam's Door. I like to say it, True Tales of Madness and Hope. We have to get the real voiceover guy in here. Anyway, we're going to be talking about his latest book. And by the way, he is an award-winning author. Many of his books are just amazing. We're also going to tell you how you can find out about Mark, also get Dr. Rubenstein's other books, and his latest, which we're talking about today, as I was mentioning, Bedlam's Door. And this is part two, True Tales from the Couch and the Courtroom. It's a fascinating book. Now, Mark is an amazing man. He's an award-winning novelist, physician, psychiatrist. He's written seven nonfiction books in the medical and psychological fields. He's authored four novels, three novellas, and the list goes on and on. And I'll give him more accolades as the show goes on, because it fills up a whole page here, and we're wasting time to find out how you can be a fly in a psychiatrist's office. So I want to also invite everyone, if you'd like to email me. We're taking email questions today. StraightTalkDoc@gmail.com, StraightTalkDoc@gmail.com. If you have any questions or comments, we'd love to hear from you. And I know my special guest would as well. Dr. Mark Rubenstein, thank you for being on the couch here. Oh, I'm laughing because we had so many emails pop up all of a sudden. So anyway, welcome to the couch, Dr. Rubenstein. Nice to have you.
Nice to be here with you, Michelle.
Do you know what? I think I have never asked you why you became a psychiatrist. I don't think I've ever asked you that question.
I don't think you have. The answer for me is really pretty simple. It may sound strange, but I became a psychiatrist ultimately when I really thought about it, because I've always loved stories. As a kid, I just loved reading virtually anything I could get my hands on, whether it was Aesop's Fables or Grimm's Fairy Tales, and as I got older, all kinds of novels and stories. When I went to medical school thinking I'd become an internist or, in one of the medical specialties, I quickly discovered that when you saw one case of hypertension or one case of heart failure or one case of diabetes, it was very much like all the other cases. That's the way the patients presented, and the treatment was whatever it was. Yeah. When I did my psychiatry clerkship, however, I discovered very quickly that you might have 100 different people, 100 patients, all presenting, let's just say, with depression, and they all had different stories, different trajectories, or if you will, narrative arcs leading to the same final common pathway or diagnosis. So having always loved stories, I figured every patient has a story to tell, and every story in its own way is fascinating. And while there may be only 20 or 30 different diagnoses, there are millions of people. You know, as the old byline went for that program, it goes all the way back to the 50s. There are 8 million stories in the Naked City.
That's
so
right.
Everybody has a story, and I love stories. And there's, I mean, psychiatry is the only medical specialty, along with psychology, where, you know, you sit and you listen to people tell you their stories. And what could be better than that?
Absolutely. I don't know about you. That's why I'm asking you. But do you sometimes, when you leave the office, say, am I a voyeur? What is this about? Why am I so fascinated with hearing people's stories and what's going on in their minds? I don't mean to put you on the spot here, but I mean, I just...
No, you're not putting me on the spot at all. There are some psychoanalysts and psychiatrists who firmly believe that deep down, every psychologist and psychiatrist is essentially a voyeur.
Yes.
And that may be partly true, but I think also you're not just looking, you're also trying to understand.
Yes.
And you're trying to get the lowdown on what, for lack of a better term, I would call the human condition. There are also many mental health professionals who believe that fundamentally, in addition to perhaps there being a dollop of voyeurism, every mental health professional who really treats patients is ultimately, in addition, trying to find out more about himself or herself.
Yes.
And I think that's probably to some extent true, to an unknowable extent, but to some extent true. So there are, I think there are probably many, many reasons why one becomes almost anything, and they're not necessarily conscious reasons or reasonings. We are led to where we go because of many forces, some of which may be unseen.
Isn't that the truth? And I know you know so many colleagues who have said the same thing. And in terms of their own personal issues, yes, that's why I became a psychiatrist or a psychologist. So I can really understand the unfolding of why I think the things I do and what's going on within me. And to, of course, like you said, unveil some of the subconscious thoughts and feelings. So, yep, you nailed it.
Well, I hope so. We always try to nail it, but we often miss, you know.
Well, we do. And that's in life, I guess, huh?
Yeah.
Things happen for a reason, I always say. And as my partner always says, stuff happens, so don't go there.
That's right.
Well, let's get to your book. It's Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch and Courtroom. Fascinating read. I mean, I couldn't put it down. Good stuff. Fascinating cases.
Well, I tell you, you know, there are 21 stories in the book, with each one having an afterword where I do my best to explore and explain a little bit about what was going on and how I understood the patient to the best of my somewhat limited ability. But on the other hand, I view each of these 21 stories as being almost a mini novel, if you will, a mystery novel, because each person presents with something of a mystery. You know, what is this that I'm seeing? Why am I seeing it? Why does the person present this way? And how can I understand it?
Yes.
And, you know, those are the elements that make up a good mystery or even a thriller novel. You know, how are we going to get out of this? Or what's going to happen next? And what's the outcome? And how do we get there? So, I also wanted to go beyond Bedlam's Door, with Bedlam's Door having been the first book, because this one takes me out of the hospital and with outpatients, people who I saw in my private practice, people who I saw in a nursing home or in an assisted living facility or in consultation for a courtroom situation or a workers' compensation scenario. And I thought it would shed additional light on the fact that you don't have to see people who have been hospitalized psychiatrically to see some of the most bizarre things that you'll encounter. People walking around in everyday life sometimes have the most incredible stories to tell.
Yes, they sure do, and you bring them out in your book, Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch and Courtroom. In your book, several times you mentioned that you were hired by attorneys as an expert witness at trial. So I was fascinated to find out from you if you ever felt that you were hired like a hired gun or, you know, or a hack or something. Did you ever feel uncomfortable about some of these situations?
There were times I did. Mm-hmm. I did my best over the years to never let myself be a hired gun or a hack. I, as a matter of fact, as I say in the book, when money, medicine, and the legal system combine, sometimes truth is the biggest casualty. I indicated in one case an attorney in the middle of my testimony, there was a recess, and he took me aside and he said, "Hey, look, I want you to mention the term brain damage."
Oh.
And I said, you know, I said, "This patient doesn't have brain damage." He said, I know, but I just want the jury to hear it." You know, and he was thinking, of course, this would increase damages. And I said, "That's bull."
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "Life is bull." And I said, "Excuse me, my life is not bull."
Yeah, Mark, you go. Yes, sir.
Yeah.
Wow.
And you know, there were some attorneys, relatively few, but there were some attorneys, if they represented the plaintiff, they wanted you to maximize and even exaggerate damages and gild the lily. Some attorneys who were defendants' attorneys wanted you to minimize the damage. In one case, I pointed out in the book is a woman who had been raped at knife point in front of her child, a 2-year-old baby, and in order to get her to submit, the assailant held the knife to the child's neck and threatened to kill the baby. So, so you know, it was just a most horrific scenario you could ever imagine.
Yes.
And the defense attorney wanted me to do my best to minimize the damages. And I said, "You have got to be kidding." And this woman, she couldn't even walk into an apartment building anymore. This intruder had snuck into the building pushed her into her apartment and consequently, you know, threatened the baby and raped her.
So,
you know, you ran into all kinds of attorneys, and I do point out there are a couple of stories in the book where attorneys of one stripe or another wanted either a minimization or a maximization of the damages and of the psychiatric realities and facts of the case. And, I always felt that to maintain my own personal integrity, I had to just, and what I found also, by the way, and it really isn't ironic at all, that to tell the truth, to tell the clinical truth, was really the best way to go about my business, because, you know, in, on a very practical level, aside from self-respect and all of that, attorneys learned to respect your opinion, and they would come to you when they really wanted to know what they had or didn't have in the way of damages in a case.
Yes.
So in the end, it really worked out very well, both on a personal level, in terms of my own self-esteem, my own self-respect, and also financially, because I never wanted for business, so to speak. People came to me, and they knew they were going to get the actual truth, and that's, you know, the courtroom is supposed to be a place where the truth emerges, where two sides tell their adversarial stories. It's sort of gladiatorial combat in the modern age, you know, with words, not swords. And the finder of fact, namely the jury, decides which expert to believe.
Yes.
And the best way to be credible is to simply tell the truth, because if you tell the truth, you don't have to remember any lies.
Boy, is that the truth.
Yeah, that's the truth.
By the way, guys, you're here on LA Talk Radio, and you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle, and I'm speaking to one of my absolute favorite guests, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. He's been on the show before. He is a psychiatrist. He is, of course, a professor. He's an award-winning author, many books. If you're a fan here on the couch, you've heard him talk about many of his books, nonfiction as well as fiction, and we're going to tell you how you can get those books at the end of the show and find out more about his latest, the one we're talking about today, Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch and the courtroom. And if you have any questions or comments, I see they're coming in, but give me a little more time, guys. I will try to answer your questions or have Dr. Rubenstein do so at straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. They're usually, psychiatric questions, Dr. Rubenstein, which can sort of meld with what you're saying in your book, some of the stories that you weave. So we'll get to them, guys. Don't worry about it. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's a very difficult and it's poignant to say, tell the clinical truth. It brings up an idea in my head about a client I had years ago. The attorney who was representing him said, it was a small car accident. He said, he's suffering from PTSD symptoms.
Mm-hmm.
Really?
What? Go ahead. Let's
look through some of those traumatic symptoms described here. No, I don't think so. So I've been pushing. You do know that this client has these issues. You do know that. No, I really don't think he meets the criteria. Not going to happen. So I do know what you're saying, and you more than anyone, because you are a forensic psychologist as well as an expert witness in many cases. So you know the deal.
You know, over the years, I concluded that PTSD is probably the most abused diagnostic category in the legal forums. I had attorneys contact me with a client who had tripped and fallen on a sidewalk and who they alleged had PTSD. having interviewed and evaluated more than 300 survivors of the terrorist attack of 9/11, as well as other people who'd been through absolutely catastrophic traumatic situations, when I would get something like that, I mean, it would turn my stomach. Very easy at that point to just tell them, look, I don't think this doesn't even come close, and it's really an abuse of the diagnostic term, I wouldn't even be involved. But money does strange things to some people, and there are experts who will tailor their testimony and their opinions for the attorney who retains them.
Yes, absolutely.
There are people out there who will do almost anything for money, and that was something I always had to be cognizant of and always did my best to avoid. So it's just part of the reality of living life in this world and of being in the forensic arena, and I guess it's no different than many professional areas or businesses where, you're always going to run into some people who are either shady or who want you to bend the criteria and be quote unquote flexible meet their needs.
Yeah, exactly. Let's get to some of the stories. Speaking about you being a consultant for the New York State Workers' Compensation Board, where you did examine over 300 survivors of the 9/11 attack, what do you think was the most common diagnosis that you saw in those people, and what were some of the fascinating things that you learned about these individuals?
Well, there's no question the most common diagnosis was PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder, and these people lived through catastrophic scenarios. One case that I detail in the book, it's a story called That Terrible Day, details the story of a man who walked down, I think 60 or 70 stories in a jam-packed, crowded stairwell that was becoming increasingly crowded as he and the others descended, because people were pouring in from the lower floors.
Right.
It was smoke-filled, and they watched the firemen tramping upstairs, and of course later they realized that none of those young men lived. This is a man who witnessed what occurred when people jumped from the 100th story, because the floor was so hot they had to stand on the desks. And it was just a horrific tale. And among other things, I mean, he stepped over he ran past someone who was obese and who couldn't make it down the stairs.
Yes.
One woman had fallen onto the stairs and was nearly trampled to death by the people who were just panicking and running over and by her.
Yeah.
And if I tell you that this man not only suffered from PTSD to the extent whereby he couldn't come into the city, he couldn't ride in a subway anymore. Whenever a neighbor lit a barbecue and he smelled the lighter fluid, it reminded him of the diesel, of the jet fuel that was burning. In addition to that, because of what he did, acts of commission and omission, where he either stepped over someone or failed to help someone, he suffered from survivor's guilt, and he basically felt that he was no longer alive. So a combination of PTSD and survivor's guilt was something that I saw with alarming regularity in these people. And some of them even moved away from New York City or the environs. They came from New Jersey and other areas, Westchester. One fellow I examined, he ended up moving out to rural Pennsylvania. So he couldn't even tolerate the sight or sound of airplanes going overhead. So these things had enormously profound repercussions for many of these people. These were all, by the way, workers' compensation cases. People who had been at work on that day in the buildings and who had sustained both physical and or psychiatric injuries and who either couldn't work or who needed psychiatric intervention because they were so symptomatic with you name it, nightmares, shakes, generalized free-floating anxiety, nocturnal dreams, virtually the entire panoply of things that you see in PTSD. And they might as well have been returning wartime veterans from Iraq or Afghanistan. I mean, they suffered the same kind of symptoms and pathology. So that was what I saw most frequently in the survivors of 9/11, and most of them, well, virtually all of them, were legitimately injured people who really needed intervention.
And who can forget those horrifying images if we were just watching the news when it was happening, which I was doing here in Los Angeles? I mean, that's one of those flashbulb moments I will never forget. It was just,
It sort of goes up there with the Kennedy assassination and a couple of other things. You know, you'll never forget where you were when you saw or heard. And this, many of us were watching live on TV when the second airplane hit the North Tower.
Yeah, we sure did. Fascinating stories. And thank you for doing your service. And that must have, you must have been working 10, 12, 14-hour days at that time.
Well, I must tell you that a number of the people I saw were not even in the buildings at the time. They were workers who were assigned to the cleanup, and they ended up picking up body parts and charred remains and inhaling toxic fumes from asbestos and who knows what other chemicals, and suffered many sequelae, both physical and psychiatric, just from having seen the dead or the remains, partial remains of the dead, having had to pick them up and all the steps that are involved in the identification and whatever. Some of them were sanitation workers. Others were firefighters.
Horrific.
I mean, I saw a range of pathologies and of people that in an ordinary psychiatric or psychologic practice, you would never see this kind of profound pathology in such a vast array of people.
Right. I can imagine. My goodness. Well, let's talk about, you know, the first piece in your book, Ashley. Boy, you really started off with a boom here. The boom! Let's get right to the heavy story. Kevin O. story. The names are fictitious of the individuals in order to protect their identity. But this is something that I mentioned to you earlier, sounded much like a piece right out of one of those criminal ID shows and more. And it's about a psychiatrist who enlisted a patient in a plot to murder six people. Can you tell us what happened and why that was?
Yeah. the name of the story is A Place at the Table, and I'll explain that in a couple of minutes. But I saw Kevin O. in consultation at the request of his attorney. He was a plaintiff in a lawsuit, a malpractice suit against the psychiatrist. Kevin had suffered from panic attacks that became so severe he became agoraphobic. He was lucky in that he was a motorcycle mechanic and was able to set up his little repair shop in his garage of his house because he was so agoraphobic he could barely leave his home. And he was doing okay financially in that regard, but the panic attacks became worse and worse, and he began to see this psychiatrist. And over the course of a few years, the psychiatrist really helped him and put him on some medication, and he met with the psychiatrist once a week or once every other week, and he was doing quite well. And then at some point, a few years into the treatment, believe it or not, the roles of the psychiatrist and the patient began to somewhat change. The psychiatrist began to tell Kevin about his own problems. One of them being that a woman patient of his was lodging a lawsuit against him, claiming that he had become sexually involved with her and had taken advantage of her out of the transference. In any event, the next thing he knew is that the psychiatrist began asking him if he knew anybody who could get a could rent a fishing boat for him, and if he could get heavy-duty black plastic bags, and if he knew anything about navigating a boat in Long Island Sound, particularly off Montauk Point, which was a shark-infested area. Lo and behold, what became more and more clear was that the psychiatrist was planning something which he eventually told Kevin about, namely that there were some people who he felt were being very unfair to him and whom he wanted to eliminate. And his plan was to invite these six people over to dinner and to shoot them after he obtained a weapon with which to do it. And he wanted Kevin to obtain a pistol for him, thinking that because Kevin dealt with people who rode motorcycles, he might be in a position to, who knows, you know, contact some Hell's Angel type guy, you know, that sort of thing. Kevin grew so frightened by this that he went to the police in the local town, and the police were, of course, not only intrigued by this, but were alarmed, and they convinced Kevin to wear a wire, which he did, and he recorded what went on, and there were other ways in which the psychiatrist crossed the boundaries and befriended and beseeched Kevin. It got to the point where they actually went to make the buy of a gun, and the psychiatrist didn't know it, but he was buying a pistol from an undercover police officer. And he insisted that Kevin be in the car with him when the purchase was made. And this was a loaded pistol being purchased because they had to have evidence, namely a loaded pistol being exchanged for cash. I think it was $1,500, something like that. In any event, this went to a criminal trial as well as a civil trial, the civil trial being Kevin's lawsuit for having abused the treatment relationship, ending up in Kevin being absolutely not only frightened and all of his symptoms returned, but he could no longer trust any mental health professional. He just felt he couldn't do it anymore. And he was suffering immensely because all his panic attacks returned. And I was asked to comment and opine as to whether or not the psychiatrist deviated or departed from standard and accepted psychiatric practice.
You think?
I'm laughing, but, you know, I was sitting there. Meanwhile, this ended up with the psychiatrist, of course, losing his license, but on the other hand, only doing a month of jail time because they really didn't have any hard evidence. And he claimed, probably with some justification, that he was not only under a great deal of stress and strain, but that he was temporarily psychotic at the time. And he was. The story is called A Place at the Table because the psychiatrist had planned on inviting these six people over for dinner, and Kevin was left at the end of this, including at the end of the civil lawsuit, feeling that someday there might very well be a place at the table for him.
God bless him.
And that's something he'll live with for the rest of his life, because this psychiatrist was not only crazy at the time, but who knows what will happen with him in the future.
Yes, who knows? That's right.
And he lost his license, and I don't know where he is now, but... The book also details another malpractice instance in which a man, a psychiatrist, had an affair with a woman patient of his, and when I learned of this, a group of us were sitting in a diner, and this psychiatrist said that he thought that his sexual relationship with this woman would very possibly be therapeutic for her.
Sure, of course.
Because her sex life with her husband had diminished to nearly zero.
That's true.
So I remember asking him, I said, tell me, what does she look like, this patient?
Mm-hmm.
He said, well, she's rather good looking, and he described her, and indeed, she was a former model, actually.
Oh, okay.
And so I said, well, you feel this might be therapeutic for her. Do you do this kind of therapy with your ugly patients, too? In any event, he ended up getting sued because he did follow through on this, and
I was
ultimately asked to be involved in this lawsuit, providing an opinion as to whether or not he had departed from standard accepted psychiatric practice, and I turned the case down because I knew this man, and of course that would render my testimony assailable. The defense attorney might end up claiming that, well, you never liked Dr. So-and-so.
Uh-huh.
So, you always have to be careful of what a collateral attack might involve, namely an attack on you as a person, not just an attack against your scientific or psychiatric testimony.
Oh, so, absolutely.
There were all kinds of crazy, strange situations I ended up encountering.
Oh, I know you did. And by the way, guys, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch with Dr. Michelle here on LA Talk Radio. My special and one most favorite guests today is Dr. Mark Rubenstein. Well, he's a physician, of course. Not only that, he's a psychiatrist, novelist. He was formerly a clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at Cornell University Medical College and an attending psychiatrist at New York Presbyterian Hospital in New York City. And the accolades go on and on. But we're talking about his latest book, Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch and the Courtroom. And there's some fascinating stories in here about individuals and groups of individuals that Dr. Rubenstein encountered. It's a fascinating read. And, you know, you can learn a lot as well, listeners, about particular disorders, why people do the things they do. Really brings a lot of... fascinating, better than watching, and I'm sorry, producers, I know some of the producers over at the ID channel, but it's better than watching some of these shows. Yeah, I mean, really, this you've got to put these out there, Dr. Rubenstein. You've got to sell these, write these scripts, because they're amazing. They're just
well, there is some interest in turning this into a TV series, so we'll see what happens.
Good
but
for you.
Some young psychiatrist who's struggling with his own personal life and who ends up seeing all these fascinating cases, you know.
Yeah. And he tells the clinical truth. So, another great story that you talked about in this book was talking about John's state of mind in regards to telling you that he wanted to get rid of his supervisor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, of course, we've had all the shootings, the recent case of the UPS worker who just gunned down 3 men at his workplace in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, he killed himself as well. But, wow, can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, you know, it was a very interesting and sort of difficult scenario. What's happened recently is that the law has changed. You know, there are different types of law. There's statutory law and there's case law. Mm-hmm. Case law means that laws evolve over time based on case decisions that are made.
Right.
Recent case decisions have indicated that psychiatrists, psychologists, physicians are responsible to report suspicious or potentially dangerous behavior. It used to be when there was a reasonable degree of certainty.
Yes.
Or when now it's changed into whether there's a probability
that
someone might be dangerous to other people. This is, of course, derives from the famous Tarasoff decision years ago, where in California, a sick, psychotic young man killed a woman, a college student, whom he was enamored of, and she didn't return his affections, and he ended up stabbing her to death.
Yes.
And it was, you know, decided that the mental health professional has a duty to report to the police or to a third party when another person outside the therapeutic duo is potentially in danger.
Yes.
Well, that's expanded over time to the concept of probability, where it's probable.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what most people don't realize is that probability in the law means if there's 51% chance or greater of something happening, it's probable.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, what that does is it places a burden on the psychiatrist or psychologist so that if that mental health professional thinks there is a probability that the patient might do something to someone else, he or she is duty-bound to report it to the police. Well, I'm dealing with John, and he comes in and he says, I'm really in a bad way.
Mm-hmm.
If I could get away with it, I would shoot my supervisor.
Oh my gosh.
Well, he says this to me, and I'm sitting there and I'm listening to this. So I make an assessment as best I can.
You in know, your calm manner.
Does he own a gun? No.
Right.
Has he ever been violent in his life? No. Does he have a tendency to become violent? I ask all kinds of questions, and I'm doing my best to evaluate if there's any real truth to this scenario, to this possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Because almost anything's possible, but probability means just 51%.
Yes.
What about the other 49%?
Right.
I mean, where do you go? And then, you know, you run the risk of violating the patient's confidentiality, in which event you can get sued. So you're really between Scylla and Charybdis, and it's very difficult to know what to do. Well, I struggled with this for a while, and lo and behold, I was very lucky because what happened was, and this supervisor was really picking on John. He was really making his work life miserable 5 days a week. It was just incredible. And he couldn't get out of the situation. He couldn't get transferred over to another. But as it ended up very well for John, the supervisor himself was transferred to another department. But what it really involved was this man was using the figure of speech.
Yes.
I'd like to shoot the guy.
Oh,
you know,
right.
There I was forced into a situation where I had to really do my best to assess the probability that this might actually occur.
Yes.
And I had to go through the whole rigmarole of trying to figure out how realistic this might have been and what the consequences might be, what danger existed for this supervisor, what danger existed for myself in terms of violating a patient's confidential communication, and on and on. So, you know, being a physician these days has become very difficult in some ways.
Right. Exactly. Extremely difficult. What a fascinating story that is. I just love that one. Yeah. We have a listener here, Josh, and I think this is a really important point. I thought I would just sort of answer this email that came in. Well, I think I'll have you answer it. How's that?
If I can.
I know you can. He said, Doc Michelle and Dr. Rubenstein, when I was listening to you talk about all of the people suffering from PTSD, I have come in contact. I'm so sorry. So sorry, Josh. My eyes have to focus here. I've come in contact with many people, especially at work, who are bullies and act out angrily, who always apologize for their misbehavior by saying, oh, I think I have bipolar disorder. So do you think a lot of people make up this excuse, because I hear it all the time, in order to get out of misbehaving or being inappropriate? That's a good question.
But it is a good question. Of course, you know, it's impossible to really know for sure without having examined someone. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to just give a flippant answer. But there are many people who abuse the concept of some psychiatric disorder in the service of either excusing themselves or minimizing the meaning or impact of their behavior on others. So, it's certainly possible. Whether it happens in many cases or the majority of I have no way of knowing. Mm-hmm. But it certainly is a very real possibility, and I have no doubt that there are people out there who do use these labels as a means of excusing themselves.
Yes, exactly. I agree completely. Mm-hmm. I hear it all the time thrown around, just in societal gatherings. just excuse him. He's bipolar. It's like a joke or something. But I mean, I think it's rather unfair sometimes, from my point of view, that a lot of people kind of throw this disorder around.
Yeah, they do, and no disorder really excuses that kind of behavior in a social context.
Well,
if someone is truly psychotic or is a schizophrenic and really can't differentiate reality from fantasy, certainly you do your best to understand that. But somebody mm-hmm. who's just acting inappropriately or who's saying things that are hurtful or bullying other people, these labels don't provide a reasonable excuse.
Well, exactly. Guys, in case you just tuned in here, you're on the couch here with Dr. Michelle, my special guest, one of my favorites, of course, Dr. Mark Rubenstein. We're talking about his latest book, Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch in the Courtroom. And we're going to tell you in just a little bit how you can find out more about Dr. Rubenstein's other books. He's written amazing nonfiction books. If you are a regular listener here on the couch, you've heard me talk about them to him. We've had great interviews, and there are more to come, of course. If you would like to email us, there's some more questions coming in. We're going to try to answer them, straighttalkdoc@gmail.com. And I'm really happy to help you out, guys, if you have any questions or comments. Dr. Rubenstein, is there a message for readers in general? And I know we sort of touched on this at the beginning, but a general message in your Beyond Bedlam's Door latest book, True Tales from the Couch in Courtroom.
I don't think I wrote the book specifically to send a message or messages, but mm-hmm. I guess there are a few. One is, and I made this point in Bedlam's Door, is that almost any bizarre kind of behavior can be understood if we take some time and mm-hmm. listen to people and try our best to understand them. By we, I mean, mental health professionals. And part of what drew me to psychiatry was that I'd have the opportunity to sit and listen to people and interact with them and get to understand them as best I could, to understand the human condition. Another thing I wanted to convey is that there are many misconceptions about psychiatry and about the legal system and about what goes on in courtrooms, and I wanted to dispel some of them in terms of what attorneys are all about and how they conduct themselves. And I think that gets illustrated in the course of some of the stories. Another thing I wanted to convey to readers is that almost everybody uses the term, he's got Alzheimer's.
Right.
And Alzheimer's is used as a general catch-all phrase to cover all kinds of dementias, all kinds of cognitive brain impairments. Mm-hmm. And as I make very clear in the story about someone who has dementia, in the afterword, there are different kinds of dementia. Alzheimer's does not describe even nearly all of them, although it's certainly one of the big ones.
Yes.
And I differentiate some of the different kinds of dementias. It's difficult to sit and hear people talk about Alzheimer's all the time when they're really describing something else.
Absolutely.
So I wanted to demythologize some of the issues concerning Alzheimer's disease and the dementias.
Yes.
I guess if I look at almost any of the stories, I could say, there's a message here. But, I just thought they were fascinating stories, and they shed light on certain issues in psychiatry and also about life in general.
Oh, my goodness, they really are fascinating. Couldn't put the book down. And on that note, you know, with the elderly, there, I really appreciate how you point out some of the misconceptions about the elderly. And there are some unusual stories about older people in a nursing home. Yeah.
Yeah, well, these people were not even in a nursing home. Yeah. In one story, I called it inventing sex.
Right.
It's a group of older people who are in an assisted living facility. This is not a nursing home. These are people who, for physical reasons, need some help with daily functions, and they're all intact people.
Yes.
A few, you know, former doctors and lawyers and accountants and very successful business people, men and women, and there was a tendency that I saw right away, and it's sort of humorous and very interesting to see what happens when they have their weekly meeting, and the social worker is conducting the meeting and is really relating to these people as though they're infants, because they're in their 80s, some of them are in their 90s, and the way she was relating to them was very infantilizing, and they took umbrage at this, and it's a funny story, but it's very true, and we all, I think when we're not thinking of it, we're not cognizant of it, we tend to relate to much older people as though they're children.
That's true.
And these people resented that, and they made it very clear, and again, the title of the story is called Inventing Sex.
Right. It's great. And that's what's called a tease, folks, for the book. Dr. Mark Rubenstein, what's the best way we can get a hold of your book? Your latest book, Beyond Bedlam's Door, True Tales from the Couch and Courtroom, and, of course, all of your other fiction and nonfiction books.
Well, the easiest way, I know we live in a digital age, and the easiest and probably the cheapest way is, certainly if you have a Kindle or a Kindle app on any device, you can get the book for $4.99 on Amazon. Mm. You can get the paper version for, I think it's $10, $11, I'm not even sure, on Amazon. Also, although it's available in bookstores, and if the store doesn't have it, they can get it in a day or so. They will contact the distributor, and again, I have no preference as to where anybody goes to get a book, but the easiest, I know I buy a lot of books on Amazon.
Right.
And
exactly.
I'm getting so lazy I don't even leave my house anymore.
Why not? Walk the dogs and you're done. There's your exercise.
That's right.
and of course, you can find out more about Dr. Mark Rubenstein at his website. And what is that website again? Easy.
Yeah, www.mark, M-A-R-K, hyphen, Mark Rubenstein, M-A-R-K-R-U-B-I-N-S-T-E-I-N, hyphen author.com. The website says a little bit about me. It gives some questions. It also has some questions for book groups and other things there I don't know, maybe people find interesting, maybe not.
Fascinating stuff. No, it's all really good. Thank you so much for being on the couch here. We're out of time, as usual. But
thanks for having me, Dr. Michelle. It's always a pleasure. You are a great interviewer.
Oh, well, you're a great guest. As always, the best. And always appreciate you taking us through the mysteries of the mind.
It is mysterious.
Have a great weekend. And
you too.
Thanks. Thanks a million for being on the show.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now. All right, guys. And all of my shows, of course, are up in the archives starting now. So if you missed this interview, you can listen to it, download it, replay it right now if you'd like. All the content and information about Dr. Mark Rubenstein's book will be up in the archives this weekend. Also, my shows are free on iTunes Podcasts on the Couch with Dr. Michelle here. Thanks again for listening. Next week, more wonderful stories about helping you with your issues. From another great expert, as usual. As I always say, do take care of yourself first, and then you'll be great for others. That's the way it works in the world here. Have a good one now. Bye-bye.
Got you on my mind again tonight. Seeing flashing rays across. coming light.